The following talk was given by Steve Hagen in Minneapolis on March 29, 1994. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Okay, well, good evening. This is the second talk on the Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Now that you've had a chance to look over and think about what we talked about last week, did any questions arise about anything that we covered so far?
Yeah, sure. On page 33, you talk about, right in the middle, Dokken Zenji said, time goes from present to past. You were talking about it as a kind of something that doesn't make logical sense. But, I actually think that's sort of what our experience is. And time starts out, it appears in the moment, right? All of a sudden, here's time, and then it runs away. If you see what I mean, there's a moment and the moment disappears somewhere into the past.
Well, that's what time is.
Yeah.
Time is that.
Is that.
Time is not something that appears here. Because what appears here is now. Mm-hmm. And now isn't time. Now is eternity.
Now is eternity, but we then measure it and call it time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this whole series from past to present to future, that spectrum is what we call time. We think that that's real, that this is what's going on, that this is what happens. But actually, our actual experience is right here, right now, this. And this has absolutely no duration whatsoever.
So if we had to say it was anywhere, you'd say it's in the present. It's in none of those.
Well, it is the present. But
it is the present.
Yes. But the present, in order to be something other than eternal, would have to have some duration. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
It would have to have some duration.
And
or to have some kind of size, mm-hmm. it's really sizeless time-wise. But this is where we are, and it is always like this. This is always the situation. Within this moment is the past, including when I said past. Well, of course, now that's past. That's in this moment. Same thing with the future. It is now. But we think the future is of course, what is the future? The future is something that hasn't gotten here yet, So in that sense, the future isn't here. The only way the future can be here, the only way we can ever experience the future is right here in this moment now. So sitting in this moment right now, we experience the future, but we experience it as kind of a fantasy. We can think about it, wonder about it, but it's actually something that doesn't exist because what exists is here now. See, so the future isn't real in a sense. Same thing with the past. Past is not here. It's gone. Where is it? It's nowhere. It's past. But this whole spectrum then of past, present, and future that's time. That's what time is. And we think that time marches on from the past to the present to the future. Well, actually, this is quite ridiculous. If we just look very carefully at our experience is always this, here and now. So the past isn't real because we can't get our hands on it. The future isn't real because we can't get our hands. There's nothing we can point to there. Same thing with now. Finally, what the Buddha pointed out then is that even now isn't really real either. In the sense that we think of it as being innocent, because you can't grasp it. There's nothing there either, because now this moment has no duration. It's sizeless. But nevertheless, that's where we are. We're always there. And, of course, in this moment now, is always presenting to us this sea of change, this constant flux and flow. If it weren't, then everything would wink out. It just wouldn't be anything at all, as far as any conscious experience could be. Conscious experience needs this and that, and that's flow, that's change. Does that all make sense? So what Dogen means when he talks about time flows from the present to the past, it means that here in the present, which is where we are, we can go back into the past. But this is a mental exercise. It's something that you're not actually, it isn't 1946 now, We don't enter some kind of time machine, but we can think about the past, we can study the past, we can study history and all of this, but you're doing that here, now, in this moment. Because this is where we are. We're always here. It's always now, and we're always here. It's always our experience. Our direct experience is never the past.
But he says you can make past time present.
Yeah, you make past time present by, you can recall a memory.
He says there we have poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like Scott and just talking about Homer. And if it's like Homer, if it's read and understood, the feelings, you know, right now it can be alive.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah.
Meaning actually present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, that's the only way poetry can be alive, is now. You know.
That's what makes it good.
Mm-hmm. Sure. If it can do that, yeah. I think that's probably what great art is. It can do that sort of thing for us. It can evoke all of that. In this moment, it evokes all of that past. Even a past that you say, "Well, I didn't experience this past," you know, but you feel it. You can smell it, taste it, all of that. It all comes, you know, this is what great art can do, I think, for us. You know. It really moves us in that way. You know? And then we say, that's great. You know?
What about future?
Future's a little different. Well, actually, I just thought of this now, but it's kind of like, you know, Charles Dickens' the Christmas Carol, you know, the Ghost of Christmas Past. It is a nice angelic looking being, right, with long, was it golden hair or white hair, something like that, but just very beautiful, dressed in kind of angelic robes and things, if I remember. And then the present guy is very jovial and friendly, loaded up with cornucopias and things and whatever, and in a big friendly looking robe, you know. But the future is what? It's just this dark robe with a pointing finger, right? Isn't it just, you know, and inside the hood you see nothing. Or were there eyes? I can't remember now. But I think it's either eyes or else nothing at all. It's just darkness inside the hood. But it had this skeletal pointing finger, you know. That finally led him to the grave. Poor Ebenezer. So the future then is of a different nature, because the future, when you think about, well, if you think of past is something you can actually conjure up in a way, and you can say, well, this happened. Of course, our memory of the past is a distortion. It isn't a true rendering of the past, really. But the future is, we have no idea. You know? I shouldn't say no idea. We can kind of estimate you know, certain things that might happen in the near future or whatever. But the future is darker in a way, more mysterious. You know? So future's like that. So in a sense, they're not exactly like each other in past and future.
Well, one of the things you said implies that consciousness requires four dimensions to function.
Did I say that?
Well, you almost said it.
I almost said it?
In other words, that without time and space, or with consciousness and vice versa.
Yeah. Well, consciousness creates time and space, in a sense. Because the moment you have, well, in order to have motion, now you have space. And in order to have time, well, yeah, it's motion, yeah. Mm-hmm. So in the fact that in the mind is simply everything is moving. So with motion, then yeah, now you have your time. There's your time and space. So here and there gives you space, and then now and then gives you time. You know? So there we are, and that's how consciousness divides. What is otherwise a seamless whole or actual full experience is of a oneness, and consciousness divides it, and it divides it both temporally and spatially.
At the end of that discussion about time, mm-hmm. he says, Dogen also says, you know, it's some other thing, to go eastward 1 mile is to go westward 1 mile.
Yeah.
Is that metaphorical about time?
Yeah, that could apply to time too, sure.
Well, is it about distance? If it is, would you explain that?
What he's talking about there is that in the world of totality, in this seamless whole, in the last class we talked about the shadowless land, you know, beneath the shadowless tree, the community faribault. This is wholeness, this is totality. And within this realm, to go east or to go west, no different. It to go east is to go west. It's one and the same. In the world of difference, you know, in the world of this and that, which is the world of our usual understanding and consciousness of the world of conflict and difficulty, and you know, then if you go east, it's quite different than going west. And that's our usual understanding of things. But from the standpoint of enlightenment or from wholeness and totality, it is all the same. No distinction. Yeah. Or like Sun Tsang said in the Shenzheng Ming, no outside, no inside, no in between. When you have that situation, here's your non-grasping. With no outside, no inside, no in between, here's your no preference. What does it mean to pick and choose? And so the mind that sees that, you're not taken up by this world of this and that. Of course, you see the world of this and that because we're conscious. The enlightened person doesn't become like an unconscious being of some sort, comatose on a table. With consciousness comes the world of this and that, but if you see it for what it is and not take that as the reality, the final reality of our experience, then you don't get caught up in this grasping, wanting, craving. That is to see going east is no different than going west. But it's because we see that as so different than going east as quite different than going west. Yeah, now we start to pick and choose. Well, what should I do? Should I, you know, if I, and then we start to weigh it out, you know. And pretty soon the mind is very disturbed, very much caught up in various things, this and that, weighing it out. Showing preferences, showing dislikes, pushing some people out the door, pulling this person in, using people or things, whatever. And there we go. And we're completely lost. And the more we go with this, the further we get from seeing. Well, maybe we are. It's easier to get caught up in things, but it's also at a certain point you can realize there's some madness to this way of living and seeing and dealing with the world. And it doesn't have to be that way, and it really isn't that way. All we have to do is just see it and pull out of it. So I don't know, does that help that question? Yeah. Okay, anything else on this, or should we press ahead? Yeah?
Onward.
Oh, onward, yes. All right. Okay, well then starting with the section on mind waves. So he says at the beginning, when you are practicing Zazen, do not try to stop your thinking. Let it stop by itself. What do you suppose would happen if you try to stop your thinking? How would you stop your thinking? You can't stop your thinking by trying to stop your thinking.
Cognitive yeah? therapists say you can.
They say you can, huh?
Absolutely. They have a technique called thought stop. To use for disturbing thoughts or obsessive thoughts. And it's a venerable cognitive behavioral technique.
Really?
Yep.
But that's one thought, not all you can. Yeah.
Right, it stops
diverts.
Mm-hmm.
That's the
oh, sure.
Stop
okay. Yeah.
No, it doesn't
yeah.
stop
think
your thinking.
Food.
Right.
It stops thought.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it stops.
A thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It gets you off an obsessive
right.
thought. Right. Sure. Uh-huh. Yeah, you can do that.
All right. You need to argue, but.
No, I think that's quite true. Yeah, but I don't think that's quite what he's talking about here.
When I was trying to go to sleep, my mind would be racing. I would try to slam a giant steel door down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the best way to do this is just simply to notice what you are doing, which you already did, but then to give yourself permission. Be okay with that. Because what tends to make the thinking go faster is when you're disturbed by it and you're trying to control it in some way. If you just let go, like you said earlier, give it a big pasture. Or did he say that earlier? Somewhere he says that anyway. Give it a lot of space and the mind will quiet down. Whenever we try to constrict the mind or control it, it just starts to go wild. So just ease off. Just notice what's happening and ease off. Generally the mind can quiet down then. See, because it's only because having a racing mind at bedtime is a disturbing thing that the mind will continue to race. If it was okay to be that way, well, you know, there's no fun in that, and the mind will give up. All right. So this is what it means. Let's let it stop by itself. Because it will. All you have to do is just be there with it, see what's going on, and the mind quiets down by itself. You can't quiet it down. Just notice what's happening. It'll start to quiet down. If something comes into your mind, let it come in and let it go out. It will not stay long. as long as you don't play with it, it won't stick around. This is quite true. If you start to play with it, toy with it, you know, become obsessed with it, poke it around, try to develop it or whatever, well, it hangs on, you know. And it starts to branch off into various other, connected thoughts or even disconnected thoughts. That's what the mind does. When you try to stop your thinking, it means you are bothered by it. So this is simply what doesn't work. Don't be bothered by anything. So again, this is that whole thing about control that we just looked at last week. Give up on that. Just stop trying to control. Then he says something interesting. He says, it appears as if something comes from outside your mind. A little further down in the next paragraph, he says, nothing comes from outside your mind. What do you think about that? Usually we think of our mind as receiving impressions and experiences from outside. But that is not a true understanding of our mind. There's an expression in Zen that says that whatever comes in through the gate is foreign. Whatever comes in through the gate is foreign. This is the gate of our senses. You know? And if anything comes in through those gates, it's really foreign. Actually, what's going on in the mind is, well, what can we say? It's domestic. I don't know. It's really your mind itself. In the 46th case of the Blue Cliff Record, Zen Master is sitting in his cabin or whatever, and a student comes to the door, and Zen Master says, what is that sound outside the gate? Whenever they talk about the gate, it's probably talking about like the gates of the senses, symbolic, metaphorically. And what is that sound outside the gate? And the student says, it's the sound of raindrops, teacher. And the Zen Master says, human beings are inverted. They lose themselves and chase after things. And then the student says, well, how about you? And the Zen Master says, I almost don't lose myself. The student says, what's the meaning of this? I almost don't lose myself. And the Zen Master says, though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. So what's going on here? We think that, the sound of raindrops is something out there in the world, you know, beyond the gates of the senses. But as far as our actual experience is concerned, the sound of the raindrop, if you experience the raindrop, the experience of the raindrop is in your mind. It is in the mind. It is not something outside the mind. If there's something outside the mind, that is not something you're experiencing. It's foreign. If it came in through the gate, it's foreign. But it can't come in through the gate. Nothing comes in through the gate. Okay? Whatever is in the mind is in the, it doesn't come into the mind. It is in the mind. It is created in the mind itself. So he goes on to talk about the mind that holds everything here. He said the true understanding is that the mind includes everything. When you think something comes from outside, it only means that something appears in your mind. Nothing outside yourself can cause any trouble. Why? Because there isn't anything out there. Did I tell you the story of King Chaos? Have you heard that one? You know, he doesn't have any eyes, no ears, no nose, like the Prajnaparamita. He doesn't have any connections to the outside. You know, in effect, this is what the mind is. But he said, nothing outside yourself can cause any trouble. You yourself make the waves of your mind. Okay, these are just mind waves, as he said. If you leave your mind as it is, it will become calm. This is called big mind. This is called big mind. But now, if you consider what this mind is, what he's talking about here, when he's talking about big mind, he's actually talking about what the mind is. And this mind is not your mind. Your mind is what he otherwise calls a small mind. Something like that. And small mind is what we normally think mind is. But mind cannot be something like that. Mind actually cannot have something outside of it. And this is a big mind, the mind that does have something outside of it, which is how we ordinarily understand our mind. And of course, our mind is like that. Our mind, because just by calling it our mind, implies that then there's this other minds or other things outside the mind. But the mind is not something like that, really. Think about what mind is. Does mind have a boundary? What kind of boundary is it? And how do you know it has a boundary? How do you know that there's something outside the mind? Well, how on earth can you possibly come up with any proof for that?
So you're saying if there was something outside the mind, by definition, we wouldn't be able to perceive it. Because if we perceived it, it wouldn't be outside the mind.
That's right.
So it's trying to know something by not knowing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's just simply an assumption. It's analogous to the assumption of, here's all this. Now, how to get here? Well, God created it. Well, maybe, maybe not. I mean, where's the proof? Where's the proof that this was created, even? We cannot experience that. We cannot experience creation. Because in order for this to be here, this has always had to be here. I mean, it can't just suddenly appear. It's just here. But if you say that, well, God created the world, that's fine. But now you still have the question, well, then where did God come from? And, of course, then usually we end up saying, well, God always was. Well, there you are. No creation. See? But what's the basis of that? As far as our actual experience is, there is this. Just this. There's just this with no creation in sight. Just this. Okay? Same thing with the mind. There's just this. What does this talk about something outside the mind? On what basis do we make that assumption? Well, on the basis that we think of my mind, our mind. On the basis that we have a sense of a self, which is separate from other. Now, because there is this self, then there is also that other. Then it seems that there is this other thing out there beyond the windows of the senses. Okay, but like the Zen master said, human beings are inverted. They lose themselves and chase after things. They lose themselves. Losing yourself means you're losing the significance or the actual experience that is being had, that is being lived in this moment. That is to lose yourself. And then to think that there is something out there, something which you have to chase after, something that you have to control, something that you have to push away, something that you have to grasp, you know? This is human suffering, and it's all based on not actually noticing your actual direct experience. Your direct experience has nothing foreign in it. Everything is domestic. Everything is everything is right here.
Even the unexpected and unusual.
Oh, sure, but the unexpected and the unusual is only occurring to the extent that you framed something in the first place. And then things that aren't in the frame bump into it. Oh, I didn't expect this. but of course, now we put it in the frame. You know, stick it on there somewhere. And based on the way we framed it, we don't expect to see certain things, and we also can dismiss an awful lot of other stuff because, well, it's not in the frame, you know. Or we say, oh, I know what this is, and then we stop observing it. You know, we ignore. This is called conceptualization. This is called dividing reality, splintering reality. This is called consciousness. In fact, what we're talking about now is just what consciousness is as far as Buddhism is concerned. Simply taking this direct experience and chopping it up, dividing it up. And the divisions that we make is the creation of our sense of space and time. It's all a function of consciousness, of dividing this otherwise seamless whole. Yeah.
All right, I have to ask this question.
Yeah.
What about something that's not a thing, I guess, in one's direct experience, like quantum mechanics and the theory of relativity, and you're trying to understand it, and you can't?
Well, the reason we can't understand things like quantum mechanics is because we're trying to conceptualize it. Now, we can conceptualize a great deal of it, but then finally we get down to, the old classic example of the double slit experiment. You know, for those of you who don't know, you can take a photon, a single particle of light, and shoot it at a screen with two slits in it, and this photon will go through both slits simultaneously without dividing. It never becomes, because a photon cannot split. So it goes through both. Well, I don't go into the details of this, but the thing is that we can see this happening. We can perceive this. We know that this is what goes on, but we can't conceive of it. As a group of philosophers and physicists met Notre Dame back in 87, I think it was, if I remember right, to discuss how the world can possibly be the way it is. Because they know it's like this on a quantum level. Don't forget, I mean, remember that everything that you know of physically is made of this kind of stuff that behaves like this. And the thing is that they know it behaves this way, but they can't conceive of what's going on there, you see. Well, that's all that we have here. The point is that we can actually perceive what's going on, because the mind, well, that is the mind, perception. That's the whole of it. And within the whole, this kind of stuff is happening. But we try to get a conceptual handle, we try to break it down in such a way, well, it won't go. The fact of the matter is that reality will not go into a conceptual framework. So all of our concepts of reality are in fact false. They're wrong. No matter how you frame it conceptually, it can be shown to be contradictory and false, one way or another. And of course we form our beliefs out of this, and then you have people with this collection of beliefs, and you have this other group over here with another collection of beliefs, and the next thing you know, we're fighting. We can't come to any agreement, but if we could perceive the whole, perceive this shadowless land, this land of totality, beneath the tree of which we find the community ferry boat where we're all included, this kind of harmony is there, but it's only there if you can see the shadowless land, if you can get in touch with actual perception and not get taken up and caught by your conceptual constructs. So as for quantum mechanics anyway, the reason it's so baffling is because we finally bumped up against reality and we can't put it into a conceptual package. But if you understand the Buddha's enlightenment, this isn't very surprising. We should have expected it.
Because reality is true and you can't put it
into words. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it exactly. You can't put it. That's the other reason why, you know, in the end, you're not going to get it in a book. You're not going to get it from listening to anybody. You're going to get it through your own direct experience. And so that's why the Buddha said he taught as the hand is open. There's nothing hidden here. It's all right there for you to experience. But it's not about believing in something that is hidden or unseen or thinking about or conceptualized, put together, you know, like this. No, it's about actual direct experience. This is called knowing. Okay, it's not believing. And it's all direct.
Sometimes our direct experience is wrong and we know that. Could you talk about that and the example?
I don't think our direct experience is wrong, so I don't know what to talk about.
Well, here, let me give you an example.
Okay.
Okay, perception.
Sure.
Okay, I'm watching my cat go really fast across the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, my direct perception shows me at that point she has about 11 lives. Okay.
The classic Millikitty.
Pardon?
The classic Millikitty.
Exactly, the Millikitty, right. But at the same time that I'm perceiving that, I don't think, where did all those legs come from?
Okay, that is not a perception. That's a conception.
But it's not, it's that's the information.
Mm-hmm.
That's
how you've conceptualized it. That's how it's been being conceptualized in your mind. Ooh, it looks like that kitty has 11 legs, you know. That's not an actual perception.
Why is that not a perception?
Because a perception doesn't give you an object.
So you're saying that when I'm... Okay, the dichotomy I'm bringing up is when she's standing still, she has 4 legs.
Mm-hmm.
And when she's walking real fast, she has 11. And what you're saying is both of those are conceptions.
Right.
Okay. The counting in the first place is a conception.
Sure.
Looking at pieces and adding them up.
Right.
Okay, mm-hmm. Got it.
It's all, and as far as Buddhism is concerned, what we commonly call perception is still conception. Mm-hmm. You will be hard-pressed to find some major distinction between what we normally call perception and what we otherwise call conception. And so this cup here is also a concept. We think we're perceiving it. No, we're actually conceiving it. Because by the time you get to something that you even label cup, even before you label it, just registering the shape in your mind is already conception. perception doesn't present you with an object like this. Perception is providing you with the means by which you can conceive it, but perception is including everything. Nothing is omitted. There's your shadowless land once again. And to know that everything is required for anything to be, then you're in touch with perception, and that is enlightenment. To see that, to know it, to understand that's how it is. And now you also realize there's the whole picking and choosing thing. Well, sure, okay, you like pepperoni pizza and not sausage or whatever. Okay, pick and choose. That's fine, but you don't have to get obsessed over something. See?
So before I've even gotten around to counting legs, the first conception concept I've done is that cat over there, me over here.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, said legs over here, rest of the cat over here, and a number of legs. So I've...
Oh yeah,
that's just literally.
But of course there's just a whole menagerie of conceptions there, concepts, you know. And it's okay to do that. I mean, even the enlightened conceive things. But if you don't understand what's happening there, then you're caught by it. And here's your suffering, here's your dukkha, when you get caught, because you don't understand what's going on.
And so, and this is the other side of my question. What I was saying is, I was kind of saying, well, wait a minute. Then I'm not caught by my conception when I see the 11 legs and go, well, actually the cat only has 4. And what you're saying is, well, you haven't gotten caught by the 19th conception in this chain, but you're still caught by the 18 that precede it by going and still, you know, legs, cat, knee.
Yeah, well, the simple thing, as long as you have an object, you've got a concept. That's the only thing to, I think, the way to keep it straight. And so to be in touch with what your actual perception is, you have to be in touch with an objectless reality. Now, what is that? And most, you know, because we're so used to conceiving everything, we go, what? And how can you possibly have something that's objectless? Well, reality happens to be objectless. And if you see that, you know. But a simple example of it is like the quantum experiment, where our perception provides us with this, and we know, oh, this is how it is. But then because we can't conceive of how it can be that way, they... You know, it's like these physicists are right on the edge of enlightenment, or actually they even have their big toe stuck in, you know, to the world of enlightenment, and yet, but no, I won't go there. I want to have an idea about this. It's like refusing to accept what they actually see.
Can you refresh me on where we attribute the shadowless land? Because we keep referring back to it, and I remember it, but who originally said it, or was it just handed down?
That comes from the 18th case of the Blue Cliff Record. Okay, this mind is called Big Mind. If your mind is related to something outside itself, that mind is a small mind. That is what we normally think of as mind. When you talk about my mind or your mind or my idea or your idea, whatever, we're talking about a small mind. Okay, that mind is a small mind, a limited mind. If your mind is not related to anything else, then there is no dualistic understanding in the activity of your mind. You understand activity as just waves of your mind. So this is your activity. This is your, the stuff that's going on. It's just the waves of the mind. And if you don't understand how the mind produces these waves, these experiences, these feelings of objects, whether they're mental objects or physical objects, and they keep coming, like you said, if you don't possess them, you don't try to control them, they won't last long in the mind, they just, that the nature of it is just to come and go, whatever it is, then you're not caught up by that. Then you have the mind that includes everything, you know. But if you focus on those things, you know, you become obsessed with them, then you're locked into a small mind. If you're taken in by these waves, if you think the objects of the mind are real in and of themselves, then that's to be taken in, and that is to suffer. Because we're not really tuned into our actual experience. We're tuned into our idea of what our experience is, and not the actual experience itself. Okay, you understand activity as just the waves of your mind. This is from the standpoint of the big mind. Big mind experiences everything within itself. Okay, nothing is excluded. Nothing is left out. It is your shadowless land again, the community ferry boat. Do you understand the difference between the two minds, the mind that includes everything and the mind which is related to something? Is actually there the same thing, but the understanding is different, and your attitude towards life will be different according to which understanding you have. So this is very important. It's the same thing, you see, but it's just your understanding of it. In a sense, like with enlightenment, nothing changes. Everything is the same. The only thing that's changed is your take on it. Well, it's like with the call pictures that we had in that other class, where you're just looking at so many shapes on a page, and it doesn't make sense. And suddenly, whoa, you see a cow like that. You know, or those three-dimensional posters, you've seen those where just a bunch of dots, and if you look at you unfocus your eyes in a certain way, and suddenly it turns three-dimensional. So it's kind of like that. Suddenly you just have a different take on it. You're just seeing it in a different way. So in a sense, the world remains as it always was, but now you see it for the first time, in a sense, you know. Okay. So that is to see with big mind, to be in touch with big mind. But big mind and small mind is the same thing. It's just, but if you keep seeing it as, oh, my mind, where you're separated out from the world and everything in the world is separated out from each other, in having an intrinsic quality or being of its own, you know, like, say, this cup or a thought or something, that you, in other words, you think it's real, well, then you're locked into a small mind. To suddenly see it in this other way, where you're not separated out, then we say it's a big mind. And at that point, everything is taken care of. Nothing is left out. And you don't have any problems because, in a sense, you're not there. Okay? Any questions about that?
Can that be done as a conscious exercise?
No. No. If it could, then I think we would all have gotten that exercise by now, because everyone would have been doing it since ages past and instructing everyone else. That's the problem. You know, that's sort of a problem, but no, it's in the same way of you trying to quiet the mind forcibly through your will. You know, you can't really do that. What you can do as a conscious exercise is to do, well, to engage in the practice of meditation, and perhaps to study things like this, so you acquaint yourself with things like, well, our actual experience, even though it seems enigmatic, strange, puzzling for a long time. A lot of Zen texts and Buddhist writings will strike us that way for the longest time, but you become familiar with that, and at the same time you take up the practice of meditation is very helpful, and eventually perhaps through acquaintance with what to look for and how the mind functions and all this, well, you wake up, you know. So you can consciously put yourself in a state of mind or train yourself in such a way where you increase the likelihood that this can happen. But as to can you consciously, you know, step forward and create that state of mind, no. I don't think that can be done. I'm sorry. Because if it could, I'd be giving that to you. And not this kind of stuff. Anything else then with that section? I was going to move on to the next one, mind weeds. Basically, the point, I guess, here is that, I'm assuming that you've read this section now. The point is not to have a weedless garden with the practice of meditation, for example. The point is not to have a mind where nothing comes up, you know, the mind totally placid, undisturbed, just like a perfectly still, calm, clear lake. You know, that isn't the point. That isn't even really the nature of the mind. The nature of the mind is just to have things coming up, coming and going. That's the nature of the mind. So it isn't then the point of trying to have this weedless garden. The point is that when the weeds sprout, we pull the weeds and, like he says, place it near the plant for nourishment. In other words, don't curse your weedy mind.
No, he said to make use of it, and I was going to ask for an example if he could think.
Well, he did say make use of it, but, I don't know. Can you think of an example?
I just remember him, like it was the example, but he said, I acknowledge the Creator for teaching me that weeds are just the plant that grow as humans.
Right, yeah.
And for teaching me to be weed.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good.
So yeah, so weed because it's something we don't want.
Something we don't want, yeah, that's the definition of a weed, a plant you don't want. I used to be involved in agricultural research, and whenever we had a plant that was growing in one of our plots, that wasn't something we planted there, even though it might have been corn or wheat or something perfectly fine, but as far as we're concerned, it was a weed.
I can figure out that I can try very hard to kill the bare spots in my lawn, and I can very diligently cultivate them, fertilize, put in the best seed, cover it up, give it the most careful attention, and it's still a bare spot. But if I have a flower bed, it fills itself with grass.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
And this I have never understood.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid I can't help you there.
But the
thing is, you know, if you don't want, how can I say, if you don't care what the plant is, then it won't be a weed. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way. that's the best way to eliminate weeds. is to just the same thing with your mind. I mean, your polluted mind, your busy mind, your distracted mind. If that does not become a problem for you, then the mind will quiet down, behave, and you won't have such a nasty mind. So that's all we have to do, and not to become obsessed with the idea of having an absolutely pure mind or a weedless garden, because the weeds do grow. And so all we have to do is...
So
why
pull anything?
You understand what the weed is in this case. The weed is actually... You're caught in the delusion, see? People also think, like, for example, the enlightened person is suddenly this person who now you don't have weeds anymore. No, of course, the weeds continue to grow, and you can, even though you finally, you've had that flash of it, you see how it actually is, you actually experience that viscerally, not just through some idea of what this stuff is, but you've actually experienced that directly, you know, what this is, all right? We say it's enlightenment. But the next thing, you're still caught. Caught by the same old conceptual thinking that you always, you know, except now you know, whoa, and you can remind yourself, oh, wait a minute, so you don't go too far with that, you see. But what the weed actually is that you are caught. See, that's the weed. Not so much that you have the conceptual mind, that's perfectly fine, but when you're caught by it, that's the weed. And so when you've had the enlightenment experience and then you see that weed, pull that weed out. Even if you haven't, still go ahead and pull that weed out. Understand that that's what this is about, to learn to recognize what is a weed in this particular case. Not that the weed is bad. The weed provides nourishment to the plant in the sense that the weed, every time you pull one out, you're getting better at recognizing what is your delusion. You know?
Okay. So you pulled out this delusion.
Mm-hmm. Pulling it out, of course, is nothing more than realizing what it is. Yeah.
So it's purely delusion.
Mm-hmm.
Why not just chuck it over your shoulder instead of planting it?
Oh, yes, but you see what you're saying there. If you actually got rid of it, you know, threw it away...
It's delusion.
Yeah. But delusion isn't something that we should destroy. It's kind of like in the Xinqing Ming, where he said, hating the world of the senses is not enlightenment, trying to destroy it. We don't need to do that. All we need to do is see it for what it is, so we don't get caught up in it, in the dukkha, the pain, the suffering. This is all we have to do.
It's like learning from your mistakes, too.
Learning from your mistakes, yeah. Like my teacher said, you know, that's what your mistakes are. You go through life and you make all these mistakes, and they're wonderful things, you know. But we can take them on our shoulders in such a way that they just weigh us down, you know, going down the road of life and you're just being crushed under the weight of your past. You know, you don't need to do that. All of this is just, if you see it for what it is, these things are not real in that way. It's just mind stuff. Mind stuff is not, mind objects aren't real. You know, they're just mind objects, see? They don't weigh anything, you know, so just put them in your backpack. That's what my teacher said. Just put it in the backpack so you can carry it comfortably. What is it? It is your education. It is your life's learning. You know, it's very helpful for you and for others. You can offer it to people when you see them under the same kind of circumstances, perhaps. Very handy stuff. Very good stuff. Very good fertilizer. Very good material there for us. But we don't have to be weighted down by this, you know.
Would it be possible for some weeds to coexist with the rest of the things from other? I always sort of viewed that as kind of a rough thing. I always be watching kind of people pull everything out and get it all perfect.
Mm-hmm.
How would that fit in? Would it be possible to let them coexist together a little bit?
let what coexists?
The weeds with whatever else is.
With the tulip bulbs? Yeah, but once again, we're talking about enlightenment here and being awake, and the thing is that the weed is simply being taken in, thinking that that is real, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so metaphorically, a little different.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay delusions and not so okay delusions.
Yeah. I was trying to conceive.
If you want to put it that way, then the okay delusions are the delusions that you recognize as delusion. And what enlightenment is that a Buddha, being a person who's awake, is a person who's awake to delusion. That's what a Buddha sees. That's what enlightenment is. Enlightenment is just seeing delusion, seeing how it is that we're caught. There isn't anything really beyond that. You're seeing the same thing, but now you're seeing how it is that we normally get caught in this stuff, because we don't really see it for what it is. We see it as being substantial. And and if you studied this, even this stuff, if you studied it, you realize that no, that's not very substantial at all, really. It's only in our thinking, in our conceptualizing, that it becomes so. Until you actually do see directly, you know, that you take an object, whether it's a physical object or a mental object or a feeling, you know, and you can remind yourself that, well, according to the enlightened, there's something very strange about this, that this, as I commonly see it, isn't right. There's something paradoxical about it, contradictory about it. So don't be too obsessed by it, don't be too caught by it. You can remind yourself of that. But when you actually see, then you'll go right back into your deluded thinking, but then you can remind yourself, oh yeah. Oh yeah, I know what this is. Yeah. And then over a period of years after that, gradually, you know, you can make your enlightenment work on a more steady basis so you don't go too far with your delusion, something like that. So we can continue to hold that garden. Okay, and purify the mind. But again, the object is not to have a perfectly weedless garden. The object is just simply to recognize the weeds and to pull them when you see them. And don't be angry at the weed when you see the weed. You know, don't. Yeah. Weed is good nourishment. Okay. All right. Next section, the marrow of Zen. Talks about the four horses, you know. You know how the worst is not necessarily the worst. The worst could be the best. I had a little joke to go with that. When I was up in Duluth one time, there's a, what are they, meat packers? Or they make, anyway, there's a place that's famous for their sausages and bratwurst and Polish sausages and stuff like that. Anyway, one day I was going by and they had a sign out front that said, our worst is best. You know, and I...
And they said
the worst, W-U-R-S-T, yeah. Yeah, our worst is best. Yeah, anyway, that was a joke I had to get in there. But since we're skipping that section, I'll just tell the joke and get on. Maybe we'll get back to that. What about the four horses, you know? So again, in the shadowless land, it isn't the point of being that best horse, you know, that number one horse. It's just like the point isn't to have a perfectly weeded garden either, you see. And I think Americans, I think we tend to be obsessed with this kind of stuff, you know? Like, people go to the Olympics, and by God, if you don't get the gold medal, I mean, I don't want to hear about you, just forget it. You know, it's the gold medal or nothing. Or the Super Bowl, you know, if the people who lose at the Super Bowl, I mean, they're like, you know, forget them. You know, they're just, well, you know, it's crazy, you know? And I think we tend to go that way, and then we expect that sort of thing of ourself, you know, that you have to be the best. Well, what he's pointing out here is that maybe the worst is best. I don't know. Anyway, but that's kind of the gist of the thought that was in that section. But I'm going to go ahead to this nothing special, and if we have any time, we can back up a little bit. So this is on page, what, 46, I guess? Okay, I'm just going to start reading, and then... I'll make a few comments. I do not feel like speaking after Zazen. I feel like the practice of Zazen is enough. But if I must say something, I think I would like to talk about how wonderful it is to practice Zazen. Our purpose is just to keep this practice forever. This practice started from beginningless time, and it will continue into an endless future. What? What is he saying there? What do you think? Yeah, sure. This practice started from a beginningless time and will continue into an endless future. Okay? Because it's now. Now is eternal. This practice is about right here, right now. It's just being here. And this here contains all the past, present, and future. So if you're here, you have all time. And time, being a mind thing, it really doesn't have size. Same thing with space. If it's really a mind object, it doesn't have size, because mind doesn't have size. Okay, well anyway, this practice started from beginningless time and it will continue into an endless future. Strictly speaking, for a human being, there is no other practice than this practice. There is no other way of life than this way of life. Zen practice is a direct expression of our true nature. Well, how is that? How do you suppose? This is the direct expression of our true nature. There's no other way of life than this way of life. Why do you think he's saying that? What is this way of life anyway? It's awakening, sure. And it's being present, being here. And to the extent that we're not, which is our usual, everyday, common mind, we aren't really present. We aren't really here. And to the extent that you're not, then you're not really living, you know, in a sense. The only life you can have is a life that is real. And the life that is real is here now. But to the extent the mind is off, kind of wandering around in some fantasy land, future, past, distant places, this thought, that thought, this, you know, working up some resentment you had for somebody that insulted you 20 years ago, you know. I mean, we do this kind of stuff in our mind, and we get caught up in those things, and we're not really here. And to the extent that we're here, we're not living a life. It's as if we are dead in some fundamental way. Okay, there is no other way of life than this way of life. So if you want to live a life, this is the only this is the only way to do it, is to be here. You know, you have to. So of course, whatever we do is the expression of our true nature. Well, of course, even just but having a mind that spins on. But without this practice, it is difficult to realize. It is our human nature to be active in the nature of every existence. Okay, this is what the mind is. The mind is motion itself. So as long as we are alive, we are always doing something. As long as we are alive, we are always doing something. So to do something, to be active, to act, is not the issue. Because you always are doing something. You cannot help but do something. Something is happening all the time. Okay, as long as we are alive, we are always doing something. But as long as you think, I am doing this, or I have to do this, or I must attain something special, you are actually doing nothing. Why? What are you doing when you think that way?
Chasing after phantoms.
Chasing after phantoms, yeah. I like to use the analogy of you just rearranging the furniture in a room. You just keep rearranging it, and you really aren't doing anything. You're not getting anywhere. But we think we are because we're moving the furniture. So it seems like we're making progress here. But whether the couch is here or over there, you know, next year you put it back again. I mean, you're just rearranging.
And you interrupt your flow as you describe where you are, too, mm-hmm. I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then of course, what this is, well, what is this kind of mind that is caught up with this? Well, this is the mind that is seeing self and other. This is your splintered mind. This is the mind that is caught up in the division of the world.
It's really kind of a scam.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
Yeah, it's a scam.
Wouldn't a scam mean that somebody's pulling it on you?
Yeah, but you're pulling it on yourself.
Yeah, you're pulling it on yourself. Yeah.
That's really all it is. You know, I think of it's a very common scam in education. You rearrange the furniture, you come in, you say you're a big deal consultant, and it'll cost them $500,000, and they'll have to, for you, and then they'll have to spend $200 million, God knows how much, for like the university's commitment to focus, mm-hmm. God knows how much they spent doing that. And they thought it was a real progress. And after 4 years of it, they decided they would go back to exactly what they had before. And another $7 million, and thought that was real progress. Mm-hmm. And then there's people who, you know, their job is to scam organization. And then there's people who scam themselves. But this is no different.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, when you talk about being taken in, mm-hmm. that's what happens in a scam.
Yeah.
You get taken in. Mm-hmm. So we are scamming ourselves.
Yeah, in a sense, except I don't think we're consciously plotting to dupe ourselves, you know. I think we do it because we're actually ignorant, you know. We don't know. If we knew what we were doing, we wouldn't do this. And I think for people like us who come to something like this and try to study this, you know, it's like we have a sense, yeah, I'm doing something here. What is it? We're trying to see what that is. Okay. But he says, when you give up, when you do not long for something, when you do not try to do anything special, then you do something. Why? Well, it's because now your doing is in accord with reality, with what's actually happening, with what's going on. And your action becomes kind of chaotic. It's like, no, with that, you can actually put the dots in a random order on the page, you know, that he talked about earlier. If you have that kind of approach, that kind of attitude, that kind of mind, when there is no gaining idea in what you do, then you do something. In Zazen, what you are doing is not for the sake of anything. So this is what we call useless Zazen. You know, useless Zen meditation is actually useless. If you really understand what the meditation is, it is useless. And my teacher used to teach this, and then I remember, and I used to say it too when I first started giving in meditation instruction. I still do on occasion from time to time. If it seems appropriate, I'll bring it up. But I remember one time somebody scolding me. Don't say that. Don't tell people that. It'll confuse them, you know, that meditation is useless. But this goes right to the very heart of the matter, that useful activity is what? There's your shadowed land again. Here's your this and that. And now you start to use something. And if you're going to use meditation, for what purpose are you going to use meditation? To get what?
Enlightenment.
Yeah, but what kind of enlightenment can you possibly have with a grasping mind? You see, if you really want enlightenment, notice what this is. This is just the grasping mind. It's the complete antithesis of enlightenment, you see. And so you can't approach enlightenment by our usual means, you know, by grasping. So that what the meditation is finally is that, yeah, sure, at the beginning, in order to meditate, you have to want to do this. You're going to have to, you know, sit down and you know, make an effort and all of that. But if you're going to use it, if you approach it from the standpoint of I will do this for the sake of that, I will sit meditation so that I can become enlightened, notice that what you have right there is the grasping mind, which is the mind of delusion itself. Therefore, you cannot approach it in this way. You have to just simply go ahead and do it. That's all. Just do it. Without the idea that I'm doing this for some reason, for some sake. So enlightened activity is just to do it, just to be there and to do it. And you're not doing it because of something other than what this is. Because the moment you do that, you've splintered the world. And to have splintered the world just means you don't see what this is.
How do you answer your question? Why should one?
Why should one do anything else? That's the question.
If someone who is unfamiliar with
it, yeah,
to you, or I've had this question asked to me, and I never quite know how to answer.
Yeah.
At all.
Well, what I finally realized, and I guess what got me started, was I was just tired. I was just plain tired
of the
I do. Yeah, I get it frequently. But what I'm saying is that in my case, for example, I got tired of the grasping mind, you know? And if you want to transcend that, if you want to get beyond that, well, you just simply have to in other words, if meditation were just another activity, our usual activity of trying to get, then what's the point of doing it? That is your useless thing. It's like our usual activity. That's why it's like rearranging the furniture in the room. That's why he's saying that you're trying to bring something about, but it's like you're not really doing anything here. You're very busy, but not, you're not getting anywhere. You're still suffering. You're still confused. Okay, now if you want out of this, you got to do something quite different. And what is it that you have to do that's quite different, that's radically different from how you do anything else? Well, say you do it even though it's useless. You do it for no purpose. You do it not to try to achieve some end. Because enlightenment isn't really like achieving an end. Enlightenment is just simply waking up. It isn't to get something. You know?
But do you think there's anything to the old idea in the contemplative traditions that it's time for part of your life to want it to be instead of always to do?
Yeah, I suppose you could say it that way, except there isn't any being, really. All there is coming and going. But, yeah, but it's like that. Being attending to what's actually going on, yeah. I think if it was phrased kind of along those lines, yeah, that's, yeah. And it's okay, of course, to enter into meditation because you want something, but gradually that has to quiet down. That will quiet down. And then what you have to do, you enter what I call no man's land here, where nothing to hang on to anymore, and you just go ahead and do it anyway. And if you can continue to do that for a while, then maybe enlightenment isn't too far away.
Well, it's kind of amazing that our oldest poem, as I went and I returned, it was nothing special, is directly translated down to like 9-year-old kids in grade school. They always say, been there, did it, no big deal. Like, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I hear people say that almost every day.
Yeah.
And I noticed that and I thought, God, that's where they got it from. Age-old tradition.
Yeah.
Not being impressed with anything.
But I don't know if that's quite the same.
No.
Yeah.
But if they say it the same way, then...
Mm-hmm. But if you go there, you would just see water and mountains, nothing special.
Mm-hmm.
But then the same thing is true. You go to the dentist, nothing special. You know, you go for your chemotherapy, nothing special. No big deal.
You just can't hold on to it.
The thing is that you don't have to make any big deal out of any of this. Death? Oh, no big deal. Here it is. Yeah. This is to actually see things for what they are. Far from making the world into something bland and dead, as this might sound, this is how the world becomes alive and fresh and breathing and living. The way we ordinarily see the world is kind of dead, where everything is dead. This is why we can use things. We can use things because we see they're dead. We can haul in the bulldozer and just start scraping up the land, knocking down the trees and moving things around. And saw a film where the Soviets did a test and thought they could alter the course of a river through nuclear weapons, I mean through an atomic blast of some kind, and now there's a lake there that is 20,000 years, it'll be absolutely deadly, I mean to go, even go near it, you know.
And a town, build a dam on it.
Yeah, yeah. But this is to use things, this is to have, you know, to carry, you know, to an extreme, that's what you're doing with the world is just there as an object to be used and manipulated by you for some ends, you know, and this is killing, this is deadly, this is poison. It is to kill the world and to kill your own life. But to go this other way that we're talking, far from, you know, people might think, well, this is kind of the guy's becoming numb here. No, it's just the opposite. This is where everything becomes alive, you know, but it's nothing special. And then you can live with it, even if it is something horrid. Like I say, with the chemotherapy, you can do that. I did that myself. And you can do it. Nothing special. But if it becomes something special, then you have a hard time dealing with it, living with it. If it's something wonderful, you make that something special, then you have a hard time living with it. But if you don't make it something special, then you can enjoy it for the beautiful thing that it is. You don't have to crave it, you don't have to try to bring it back when it goes, you don't have to become obsessed and possess it, and just experience it as it is. That is to experience life, because life is always lived in this moment. This moment is fleeting, changing constantly, you can't grasp it. And so if you stop trying to do that by making it into something special and embalming it in some way that actually kills it, then you can experience life as it is, and it's full and wonderful. It's actually alive. A little later on he says, when we express our true nature, we are human beings. When we do not know what we are. We are not an animal because we walk on two legs. We are something different from an animal. What are we? We may be a ghost. We do not know what to call ourselves. Okay, well, this is, again, you know, where we have to label things, pin things down, and we do this to ourselves. We end up embalming ourselves, and we have to put some kind of label on it. This is to try to desperately find some identity, you know, for ourselves, so we can say, well, I am such and such a kind of person, you know, this, I'm like this. This is actually to forget yourself, forget who you are, what you are. You know, as a boy, I was raised to think I was Norwegian. It was ridiculous. You know, I was born here in America. Later on, I decided, well, I was an American. But I don't know. Forget it. You know, I mean, here I am. In fact, I'm not even here. It's just this. We don't have to become obsessed with this. You know, we can forget all that and actually enjoy and live the life that is actually going on, this, which is nothing special. If we make it something special, we kill it. We freeze it out. You know, we stop it, and then we can't deal with it. Whether it's wonderful or horrible, we can't deal with it. Well, let's see. Everything is Buddha nature. Very important point. I think that's probably pretty straightforward, I guess, as opposed to everything has Buddha nature. Buddha nature is just reality as it is. Buddha in this case means awakening or enlightenment or reality, truth. Okay. But the true nature of things is not that they're something special. The true nature of things, meaning that they're embalmed, they're frozen, they're unchanging, as we commonly think things are. No, their true nature is flow and flux and change. And it's life itself. It's living, breathing life. And it's nothing special. Okay, well, anyway, I guess we're getting up to 9 o'clock. Any other, anything? Well, I would say here in the section I'm vowing a few pages back, I guess it looks like page 44 for you guys, he says, in your big mind, everything has the same value. Okay, so this is your big, this is big mind again. He keeps saying your big mind, but there's no you here with big mind. But in big mind, everything has the same value. Once again, there's that shadowless land. All right. Sun-faced Buddha on page 43. Zen Master Uman said sun-faced when he was asked, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. When he was ill, someone asked him, how are you? He answered, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Well, what should he say? I'm fine. I'm going to die. What should he say? Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. This is the whole thing. Just take it all in. Yeah.
That's the same as every day is a good day.
Every day is a good day, sure. Every day is a good day, yeah. We say our practice should be without gaining ideas. This is on page 41. Right at the very top, this is an important point too. We say our practice should be without gaining ideas, without any expectations, even of enlightenment. So since there's nothing outside, then there's nothing to get. Nothing outside the mind. Just bear that in mind. From the enlightened point of view, there isn't anything out there to go after, to grasp. To go after something is to embalm it, is to kill it. So all of these things, you know, to realize what is it that makes things come alive, and what is it that kills? Well, it's this longing, grasping thing. It's a killing kind of a thing. Dualism, to see that out there, as opposed to having it all right here in the mind itself. As far as our direct experience is, that there isn't anything outside the mind, therefore nothing to chase after in that way. And then we can actually understand this, practicing with no gaining ideas, even for enlightenment. And with that comes what? Well, that's enlightenment itself. But if we're out for enlightenment, you know, try to get it? No, that's the very action of delusion itself. And all you have to do is see that, and then that's enlightenment. Well, next week we'll move on to the next part. What is it? Right attitude, I think. Huh? Okay, thank you very much. See you next week.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.